I think being a poet and being a stand-up comedian are not that radically different. If you can't sleep, you might lie in bed making up a joke, and it's all about economy. And like, no, don't say that. Let this happen. And a poem is very similar.
It's How to Be Amazing. I'm Michael Ian Black. I'm going to tell you, listeners, I struggled with the introduction from my guest today. And it took me many tries to kind of figure it out because I felt like their work is so much about blurring lines, lines between poetry and prose and memoir and fiction and solitary consumption and performance, blurring locations, sexuality, gender. And so it was hard. Eileen Miles is the author of more than 20 books that span a career of about 40 years. And these books include Chelsea Girls, Cool For You, the recent career-spanning poetry collection I Must Be Living Twice, New and Selected Poems, 1975 to 2014. Their latest book, Afterglow, is part memoir, part elegy, part meditation, and part tribute to their late dog, Rosie. And it is my pleasure to welcome Eileen Miles to How to Be Amazing. Welcome.
Hey, Michael. Good to be here.
I have to tell you, like, I'm starting off, and even pre-interview, unlike, I feel like almost every other guest that I've had, I'm feeling the need to check in with you and make sure that I'm doing okay.
I wonder what that is.
I think I'm intimidated by you.
That's so crazy.
Well, not in terms of, like, as a person, but you have such this, I mean, you have a mystique and a body of work that I find very, I guess, impressive. And people, I'm already rambling like an idiot. People often say, is there somebody that you would be starstruck by? And I say no. And I don't feel starstruck necessarily, but I think I feel a sense of intimidation. So I'm going to apologize off the bat for that.
Thank you. I love it.
I don't. My first question, in the introduction, listeners probably noticed the use of the pronoun they. Mm-hmm. And I suspect you're tired of talking about this, but I feel like it's an important thing to address.
Yeah.
Because I know when I tell people that I'm interviewing you and I say Eileen likes to be called they, invariably there is a reaction of it takes people aback.
Right.
How did you come to this decision? When did you come to this decision? And why did you come to this decision?
I think in the past couple of years, and part of it was in my own kind of discomfort with they. Like, I knew that people who were queer and trans were starting to use this, you know, plural pronoun. And I kind of thought, I didn't like the way it sounded. And then in an interview that was about somebody else, I was dating Jill Soloway, which I hate to even bring up because I got so much attention for it that it became like a career unto itself.
It was your Brangelina moment.
Exactly. But so they, like, in I think she was being profiled by the New Yorker, and so they interviewed me as the girlfriend, and then they were asking me how I felt about they, and I was like, that's not really intuitive, blah, 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 blah. But weirdly, I brought up this thing that was the turning point, which was this moment when supposedly in the Bible, Jesus exorcises somebody and he says to the devil, tell me your name. And the devil goes, my name is Legion. And I think it's another line after that, but it's about pluralness. And I thought, wait a second, because I feel in my writing, sometimes I feel male, sometimes in my life, sometimes I feel female. It's kind of blurry, you know? I mean, I know I'm female and I have not chosen to, you know, change that, but I have all these feelings, and it seems like a time historically where we get to express that. And I thought, why not take this baggy loose pronoun and see what it feels like? And also, it's kind of a young thing. I'm in my 60s. Not many people my age decide to change their pronoun, you know, unless you're like really transitioning. And I just thought, I'm a writer. I get to do stuff with language. So why not do it in real life? Also, as a gay person, there were the years, and everybody I know has this feeling, where somebody would say, so you're dating somebody and you're at work and you don't want to really tell them you're a lesbian. So they're like, yeah. And they were like, well, who are they? And I say, well, they're a doctor. They're a writer. And you just keep using they to not expose this piece. And so I thought, I've already been using it in this way for a long time. It sort of is the sign of the homosexual. So now it's broader.
In your daily life now, do mm-hmm. you find yourself correcting people?
No, people are more correcting themselves. Like
I did. Like yes. I did, but right before we started recording.
Yeah, because I almost kind of forget in my daily life that that's what I do. You know, but it's always like in bios, like she just seems really girly to me now. And they were like, she is this. And I think Eileen's girly enough, you know, without saying she. I like the, you know, but yeah. So I think I maybe I'm getting as comfortable with it in daily life, you know, as other people apologize.
Yeah, I understand that. And it's funny. It's one of those, you know, obviously you're a poet and a writer. And so words, that's your stock in trade.
Yeah.
And so it just seems like such a, it almost feels political. I mean, it is political.
It is political.
And you've said all poetry is political. Is the act of using they, is that in line with that sentiment?
I guess. And I guess it's, I also just, it's personal. I feel like I'm still changing. And so I like to say that, you know, I mean, it's just, it's a kind of a pleasure. I mean, I think years ago when I first, when people, I mean, like people started transitioning and taking hormones and et cetera, in my wider community, just when I was going through menopause, you know, and I remember being kind of fascinated because I was thinking about using hormones too at that moment. And I thought, is it the same thing or is it different? You know? And I even had a moment and I was very confused around gender and I thought, for the first time in about 20 years, I find myself thinking about having sex with men. And I found myself thinking about becoming a man. And I just was like, what's this kind of thing about masculinity that's happening to me in menopause? And I also, at that moment, was getting my Irish citizenship through my grandparents. And so I thought, what if I like moved to Ireland and became an Irish man and then wrote poems under, I thought, what would that be like? I'd be like, you know, Michael Miles or, you know, Edward Miles. And how would my career go? And I just, you know, it was fun to think about. So in a way, this is just kind of the vaguer part of that impulse. You know, like I chose not to change my body and become somebody else exactly. But I am becoming somebody else.
As we all are. Was the idea of transitioning, not necessarily for yourself, but for people in your circle, was that ever discomforting for you?
Well, yeah, because I think it's sort of like in the lesbian world, there were like sort of at a certain point in time, people started to identify as butch or femme, you know, and then the next generation of young butches started to transition. And so then somebody who had been your student would start treating you like a lady. So it was like, wait a second, what's going on here? You know, and that you weren't masculine enough, you know? So it just kind of, and I think it's kind of changing again, even like in the poetry world, there were these new schools of poetry and are you this or are you that? And it was very combative. And now I feel like it's sort of like—
Wait, you're saying it was that way or it's becoming that way?
It was that way. And I think now it's sort of like, it's a little bit more postmodern and all styles apply. And I think in the genre, gender, you know, like schools of literature, I feel like they all have lots of similarities, you know, and they hold things and they can be combative. And then suddenly you start to realize they can take something from here and something from there and, you know, and kind of construct something new.
And it feels like you are at least partially responsible for that. As I said in the introduction, your work is a lot about blurring those lines. First of all, Do you feel like that's correct? And secondly, if so, was that conscious on your part?
You know, I guess when I was younger, I just wanted to do everything and then came upon poetry as a way to do that. But then I still wanted to do everything I ever heard of that writers got to do, you know, whether that meant writing an opera, writing a novel, writing a screenplay, you know, and then would I have time for all of that, you know? And so I think it for a long time as a poet, I felt like my thing was poetry and you know, and part of it was survival, poetry and performance art, poetry and art writing, poetry and a novel or, you know, being on a TV show or writing a screen, you know, just in a way, it's sort of like to expand and also to bring what you know to a different location, kind of.
Well, as we're talking about this, I have selected a early poem of yours from your anthology, I Must Be Loving Twice, and I would love it if you could read this for us.
Absolutely.
It is entitled An Attitude About Poetry. Or is it, when asking a poet to read, is it better to say, Eileen, would you read a poem? And then you say, if this is an attitude about poetry.
No, people are really boring and redundant with their titles, poets are, you know? So usually if somebody did what you just do, then the poet would feel compelled to go and edit. I'm not going to do that. I love that you said the title, because then I can just walk right into it.
I know, and then I totally ruined the moment, so I apologize for that.
This is our thing. My attitude about poetry is somewhat this. I should be doing something that pays more money. I love comfort, bright things for myself, and the ability to splurge on people I like, to be able to dislike people who have bucks. That is the poetry of money. Money is a friend, a comfy chair when you need to sit, free walking, buying rides. Zoom in on this one. Avoid that one in a helicopter ride around Australia. Bury my sorrows in an incredible meal. You like that star? I buy you that car. Never drunk but gliding on the ethers of everyone's drunkenness. It trips me up, my lightweight love of cash. It clicks on my teeth. My words jingle.
Before we started recording, and I said, would you mind reading that poem? And you said, I'd be happy to, and it speaks to this moment.
Uh-huh.
What did you mean by that?
Well, that poem was picked by the so recently late John Ashbery I guess he was the guest editor of the Partisan Review in 1977. And so I knew John a little bit from book parties and readings and things like that. And he was totally already my hero, one of my heroes. And it meant so much for him to, you know, endorse my work to such an extent that he picked this poem. And I just felt like it was also just in a way without, you know, without talking about things, it was an endorsement of the sentiment, you know, that this was part of what we struggle with all the time is making a buck. Everybody who writes or does anything in journalism or almost does any kind of writing, they probably started off writing poems. You're supposed to get over that and grow up. And I think those of us who decided to keep writing poems, you know, like feel all those slings and arrows, you know, coming at us all the time. So I think very much early on, and I think it is definitely a place where I wanted to blur boundaries. I wanted to talk about the life inside of the work and to some extent let that be the work.
And you come from a very kind of earthy world. I mean, you come from working class Massachusetts.
Sure.
How did you even conceive of the idea of pursuing poetry as an occupation?
Well, yeah. I mean, part of it was that it pursued me. You know, I didn't really decide. I mean, when I was in college, I took literature courses, and there was just something about poetry I got. You know, like I just liked to look at it on the page and how it didn't fill the page entirely, and it had this way of being a bit like a joke. And I just, whenever we would have these conversations...
Wait, what do you mean when you say a bit like a joke?
Well, you know, in the same way that when I would be, I mean, I'm a bit of a, I think being a poet and being a stand-up comedian are not that radically different. And
I agree.
You may lay in bed, if you can't sleep, you might lie in bed making up a joke, and it's all about economy. And like, no, don't say that, let this happen. And a poem is very similar. I liked all these qualities that poetry had that I just got it. You know, like we would have these, in class, the professor would say, let's talk about poetry, you know, let's talk about this poem. And it never seemed to me why was this such a hard thing? It seemed like the poem was right there and it was telling you what it was saying. So why are we making this complicated? So there was that. And then, and I was just like one of those kids that like was very obsessed from as far as I can remember about what I was going to do when I grew up. And I think part of it, my parents were these melancholy, they were these good-looking, smart people who were from the class that doesn't so much choose as become a cog in the wheel. And they both seemed disappointed. They had too much going on to just be like a postal worker or a secretary. You know, they wanted more and they hadn't done it exactly. And so I didn't want to be like them, you know? So I was always like, I'm going to figure this out. The problem with them is they didn't make decisions. I'm going to make decisions. But the problem was that I kept making decisions. I kept changing my mind all the time when I was growing up about what I would do and who I, you know, but the thing that happened was that in college, poetry was easy for me. And then after college, I would have these crap jobs and it was just like being in high school or college. I would be still standing there killing time. And I thought, this is what I get from my college degree. But what I was actually doing was writing a poem. And so at some point, I just had the great revelation that the through line through all these situations was the poem. So why can't that be what I'm doing, since that is what I'm doing? You know, and I, once in a while, I've made decisions in my life like that where I've noticed what is actually happening and thought, take that bus, you know.
And so that's what you mean when you say it chose you. That was the through line that was sort of propelling you forward.
Absolutely. It was where I was functioning. And to some extent, in lots of other ways, I was not functioning. Mm-hmm. So I thought, this is real.
Well, what I think is valuable about that, maybe for our listeners, is the idea, and I've experienced this in my own life, what uh-huh. you just described, this idea of maybe not even hearing yourself and what your own self is telling you.
Right.
Or who yourself is telling you are.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it's I think it's easy to ignore that voice.
Yeah. It's sort of uncanny that you would miss yourself.
Right. You talked about your parents as wanting more, and you've described them as working class intellectuals. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
People loved art. I think it was just like, it was one of my, I mean, like, nobody knew how you got there, but we lived near the library, and there was a great library in Arlington, Massachusetts, and everybody went to the library and got out a lot of books. There was a lot of reading going on in the family. And we would go to museums. We went to art museums. My dad was a mailman at Harvard, so we knew the Vogue Art Museum, and we would just, you know, there was classical music playing. It was probably not the hot most, you know, like, esoteric mm-hmm. classical music, but opera. So there was an abundance of references that suggested that we were, you know, art-loving people.
Was music an important ingredient for you, popular music, I guess I mean?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I feel like you feel like a rock and roll poet to me mm-hmm. in a lot of ways.
I mean, it's sort of like poetry is kind of, I feel like the vocalist for this band that's right. in here. Yeah.
Did you ever make an attempt to apply music to your work? I mean, I'm just thinking, I honestly, in my mind, purely thinking in terms of crassness. Uh-huh. The idea that I can be a poet and if I add a beat to it,
right.
maybe I can make some bucks.
Right, right. I mean, that was the thinking in the 70s. That was, everybody was doing that. It was like there was Patti Smith that did it and you know, Television and Richard Hell and Voidoids and all, they all did it.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine. Milton, pot of thieves. Wild cord on my sleeve. Thick heart of stone. My sins my own. They belong to me.
But I felt like I had arrived at this decision to be a poet, and I didn't want to mess it up. And I was watching my friends who were starting bands and stuff, and they just seemed like their bands were usually crap, mm-hmm. and then they weren't really writing anymore. And I just thought, I got this thing going on, so I'm going to stick to the simple little task.
Listener, here's something I need to make abundantly clear to you. If you haven't already figured it out, Eileen Miles is cool. But cool in a way that doesn't, you know, like, put you off. Cool in a way that kind of makes you wish you had a bit of that thing going on for yourself. Having spent most of their 60-something years publishing poetry and fiction and trying to make a name in the gritty world of downtown New York City poetry, Miles has broken through, deservedly, for a body of work of over 20 books. The most recent, Afterglow, is Miles's first memoir about their dog, Rosie. Coming up, we're talking about those early days in New York, getting clean, the semi-memoir, and be prepared. You might need, you know, some tissues. You've really become kind of known in some ways for capturing, particularly in Chelsea Girls, this moment in New York City in the mid to late 70s of this really creative, essential time. Mm-hmm. When you moved there, did you experience that common thing that I feel like so many New Yorkers experience when they first move, which is I just missed the train on New York? Or did you recognize that you were part of a train that was really just leaving the station?
I think both. I mean, everybody who was older did the thing that I try really not to do, which is to talk about how easy it was. You know, like we could really like leave apartments really easy because they were $50 a month on St. Mark's Place and stuff like that. But there was already a way that older poets were bitter and pathetic too. They were just all telling you like, yeah, you just think you're going to get famous. You're not going to get famous. You're not going to make a living. You're nothing special, you know? And just like, they wouldn't say that directly, but there was kind of a bitterness kind of, you know, and I just felt like I just thought because I had made a decision, this was such a big deal that I was going to act as if this was going to work. And that was the only thing I had going on was this idea that, I mean, that why couldn't it be everything? Why couldn't it be your job? You know, which didn't mean I didn't, you know, stuff envelopes and do all those things. But so I don't know. It seemed, again, I came from such a, you know, I never even had my own room growing up. I shared a room with my sister. So to be in an apartment in Soho and in the East Village, like alone in the middle of the day and just like nobody can see me, nobody can stop me. I can do anything I want. I mean, I still feel that way. Not every single moment, but just that giddiness comes up on, you know, in me where I think, oh my God, this is crazy. This is my life. Like right now I'm an adult and I can just do this or that. You know, I don't have to, you know, crumble.
It seems like you had a slow build and you've talked about it, that it, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 years ago was when you really started to get recognized in a larger way. Did you ever feel like you were succumbing to that bitterness along the way that the older poets had?
Well, not towards younger people. I mean, I would not that I wouldn't feel it, because the thing is, there's such a, it's kind of a market, and it always is more excited about somebody young than somebody older, you know? So it's like, even, you know, with this new book, it's sort of like New Yorker wouldn't publish a little piece of my dog book, but they published little pieces of all these first novelists.
Right.
And I was like, that's gross, you know? But I have pronounced that about them. And so then I sort of like sloughed it off that way. But, yeah, I mean, I just, of course, because I'm melancholic and depressive, and so I would be, like, lying in my, you know, bed or my couch thinking, oh, my God, my life is over. What did I do? What if I'm just meeting? You know, like, but the thing is, it's like, how do you get out of that, you know? And I have ways, you know. And
what are those ways for you?
You know, really simple stuff. I mean, either calling a friend who's a very good complainer, too, and just sort of laughing at our darkness, you know, because that always seems like the only way to get through it is to make a joke about it. And then just, you know, like you take a walk, you know, or go to the gym. And so like for years it was drugs and alcohol, and then I stopped all that pretty young. And so I think that sort of like I don't want to destroy myself. And because I keep making that decision, I just have to figure out ways to reanimate myself, you know, and sometimes it's like communal. A lot of the moments where it's just like I expected to be here and I'm here and what can I do? And I would come up with some communal project, you know what I mean? Like something that would involve a lot of people and be like make a gang. And because that would just be like I could exert my power that way. Sometimes I couldn't do something for myself, but I could do something for us. And that would just be kind of joyous. And then things, you know, it's the thing that's so funny about, quote, success is that you don't know where it's going to happen and when it's going to happen and what thing that you do will be liked in that way. It's like just trying to predetermine what goes viral. Time and again, I've, you know, like done a performance that I thought was amazing. And I thought, well, shouldn't this get me an HBO special? And this is like in the 80s or the 90s. And instead, I was invited to write a catalog essay for some painter. But then I got the $2,000 that I needed.
Right.
So it's just like I felt like there's a way in which I've really tried to just succumb to the kinds of success that I get when I get it. Maybe now when I have more choices, trying to get smarter about deciding what it is that I want to do.
You mentioned briefly just now that you had done a lot of drugs, drank a lot, and then you had given it up. I know you did that in your 30s. Uh-huh. And you've talked about being on a path to dying young and this idea of being one of these famous poets who,
right,
whatever, ODs.
Yes.
And you said, but I didn't.
Yeah.
That didn't.
Yeah.
Was conscious on your part.
Yeah. But sometimes, you know, like sometimes I just feel like I'm a middle child. You know, in my generation, there were three of us and I'm the middle. And it means that you play both sides. And often I feel like I didn't have best friends. I had a gang. And so I just think at all sorts of times it was like we were all doing legal proofreading in the 80s, you know, and that's how we survived. And we would get $30 an hour and we had a beeper and you'd be standing in a nightclub and your beeper would go off and a car service would show up and you'd zap down to Wall Street and you'd be like, you know, proofreading American Airlines being sold. And then when I got out of college, it was the Walter E. Fernald School. It was a state school for the mentally retarded and we were being taught behavior modification, you know? And so there's been all these moments in, and I will really say the early 80s, everybody was getting clean. It was almost a stylish move. And honestly, the people I met when I made that decision were much cooler and more interesting than the people I knew when I was drinking.
Huh.
So it was just like the nightclubs kind of shook out, just shook themselves out of people. And then of course, you know, and the next thing you know that happened was AIDS and people started dying. But it was such a momentous cultural moment where people, because I think Coke sped everything up. Mm-hmm. When people, you know, it was sort of like the East Village exploded in the 80s and suddenly it was just like, you know, galleries and cocaine and limos and, you know, and not that I as a poet was partaking in that, but it was part of the landscape. And it made everybody's drinking and drugging speed up and go faster. And I had more access to cocaine, say, than I ever had before. And so it meant that a lot of people either died or had to stop.
You said that it was stylish. It was almost stylish to stop. And there is an aspect. Your style feels important.
Uh-huh.
It feels like you cultivate a style and you embrace a style. How important is style to you? How conscious is that?
Oh, I guess I love style. I feel like it's like design. It's sort of like... it's like when you look at a wall of Facebook photos on your phone and it's like you realize that certain shapes jump out. And in some ways, without even really knowing, when you take a photograph, you're composing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you do that in time. And you're, I mean, I sort of dressed the same way I did in high school, except that this is like a Stephen Allen shirt as opposed to something that I found in Zayers or a thrift shop. Style is sort of persistent in a way. It's kind of an extension of your personality. But again, it's that thing where at some points you start to see what it is that you're doing and then you just do deeper.
An aspect of your poetry is there's a style to it. There's a visual style to it. How well does that comport with your physical style and how much do you think about design, the stylistic aspects of poetry when you're writing? I'm looking now, just for the listeners, I'm looking at My Rampant Muse for Her, and it has a kind of female form to it. I mean, it kind of undulates. Is that the right word?
Yeah, but you know, people, that was like in the 70s, and people, that was one of the ways, it was a style thing. People, mm-hmm. poems were more open and all over the place then, and part of it is we wrote on manual typewriters. So mm-hmm. you'd like type a line and they hit the carriage and it might end up here or there. It was like this calligraphic thing. So that was sort of cool.
I'm turning to your more recent work and it's stylistically, it's a lot more linear. It's
and that has something to do with this, which is a skinny black notebook.
Uh-huh.
And so poems look like that, you know? And a guy, I mean, I don't like the word mentor, but a poet who was a hero of mine that I work for, James Schuyler, who was a friend of Ashbery's. He had said this. I mean, I was already writing in skinny notebooks and I was already a huge fan of his long, skinny poems. But he just said that he was, you know, often being like an art writer and he would just always have a little notebook in his pocket. And so it just started to determine the way his poems looked.
Does the physical presentation of a poem impact the way you read the poem?
The blank spaces do. The line breaks don't. You know, the line breaks seem like there's just this economy where you're just kind of flirting with the eye. You know, you just sort of like, sometimes there's a line and it makes a complete statement, you know, like dog is good, you know? And then it's like dog is, and it's incomplete. And that makes you whip around and read in a certain way. So in a way, you're just, the line breaks just control how quickly the person reads. So if it's a long, skinny poem, they go down the page. And I like that. And I read fast. But if it's a like a stanza break, like a whole, I think I personally think of that usually or often as silence. it's been one of the things I've gotten to as I've really aged as a performer, I guess, is giving myself permission to like take that pause. Like the scariest thing, like in a podcast or on radio, is silence, right? And then a room full of people, silence, you know, but it's also awesome. It's like to take that, let that note be mine.
The example you just gave was "A Dog Is Good" as a complete line of poetry, which leads naturally to Afterglow, a dog memoir. It's a really beautiful book. It's about your dog, Rosie, and
your puppets. It's about puppets too.
It's about many things, including dog puppets. The thing that I think struck me and will probably strike a lot of people about your relationship with Rosie was the fact that you say it's the longest relationship you ever had.
Right.
And it sounds like one of the most important relationships you've had. How did you come to write a memoir about Rosie?
Well, I just always thought memoir as a genre was sort of corny. Mm-hmm. And it's not that there aren't ones that I've read that I thought were amazing, but usually it's just this, it seems sort of treacly, like, here's my memories, and they're about me, and it's sort of beautiful, and I feel a lot of things, and so that's the value of this. And it's weird, because I'm always accused, like, Chelsea, people are like, why isn't Chelsea Girls a memoir? You know, all my books, right? Why aren't they memoirs? Use your name, you know, and stuff. And I feel like, no, because I'm just making stuff up and reorganizing. I happen to have all this information about me, but I'm just using it, and I'm not using it to prove anything or to say I feel something. You know, I want to maybe show a structure or a time or a world, you know. And so with this, when Rosie started to die, I just felt something. I felt like I want to hold on to this dog. I want to preserve this dog. I had all the cheesy sentimental feelings that I've always kind of projected onto other people who write memoirs. You know, I had no compunction at kind of expressing my feelings about the loss of this dog. You know, as soon as she started dying, I started writing. It was like all I knew how to do. The material and the genre really met. But on the other hand, once I decided it was a memoir, then I wanted to mess with it.
You know? Right.
And also, there was only so much to say about the dying. I wanted to write a really unsentimental, sentimental dog book. But then she was dead. You know, it was like there was 6 months. I wrote some things. I didn't write every moment. I wrote when I felt like writing. And then I had to make up stuff. And so then it just became, I mean, I think it's the thing that's so funny about being a writer is that maybe you start going to these workshops when you're a kid, and then they give you a prompt, and they were like, write a political poem that's a villanelle, or write a poem with nobody in it, or write a poem from the opposite sex. You know, they give you these assignments. But I think the career of a writer is giving yourself assignments. You start to, a book becomes this kind of like this improvised pile of commands, you know? So it was just like, I each time I would come up with a new assignment, I would do that. And that would be that chapter. So in a way, this book feels like a series of documents, you know, that each one had some purpose and was like a new way that I could approach this book. Because I didn't know how to write a dog book, you know? And I just called it, I mean, Afterglow came in kind of late. I just called it the dog book for a long time. Or my dog.
Perfectly good name, my dog. So in speaking of the lack of sentimentality, I'm going to ask you to read a section. It doesn't feel sentimental to me, but it certainly hit me very hard. And for me, it's because, I mean, I lost my mom a few months ago.
Me too. When?
The end of May.
April 3rd.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Of this year?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, likewise.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm going to ask you to read this again, but I'll just read this thing. The world was outside the door. I think it was that sentence.
Yeah.
The world was outside that door, to me, perfectly encapsulated that moment of loss. Mm-hmm. And when you walk out the door, seeing the world does not know or acknowledge or care about your loss.
Right.
Nor will it ever, nor should it really.
Yeah.
The world is outside that door, and you have to, and you're in that space. I started weeping. Ugh. And I'm not a weeper particularly.
Yeah.
But it really hit me. So I'll ask you to read from Okay, Said the Vet till the end of the chapter, please.
Okay, said the vet, opening the door. It was Dr. Todd, the old one. So it's time, huh, Rose? Do you think I'm rushing her? This is the hardest thing in the world, she said ponderously, but in her heart. My partner and I put our boy down a few months ago. It was the hardest thing we've ever done, and we've lost a few. She's been ready for a while. It was you that was holding on. She didn't need to hang around all this time, did you, Rose? She was holding a syringe up. It was pink. This is an anesthetic. That's all that she needs, poor thing. I'll give her half and see how that does her. She pushed it in. Maybe her ass, her thigh. She stopped. She put her stethoscope down on her heart. She's gone. It was just a bear of her being still. It was all her black and white, my father's touchable body. I'll leave you with her a few minutes. Take your time. There was a thin young tech, gay, I guess, who dashed out of the room the moment her heart stopped. He came back and he put a posy, orange and red flowers, tiny, at her neck. He knows she's Rosie, I thought. He knows the rhyme. It looked so good with her colors, her enormous mouth going slack. The inside of her mouth was all out, the scar of her lip, her long jaw. We all cried and hugged. Do you want to be with her? Yes. The world was outside the door. It was Saturday morning. It was so generous to let us be in here now, just like this, just us. She was a city dog, born on the sidewalk or a roof. There was always concrete and talk. The world out there now on the other side of the wall. In here, just us. How will I ever let go of you, girl? The first one ever mine. I hugged her long body, her mouth so still. Her eyes closed, I think. I don't know. I saw this movie about the jungle. The man died under a tree. His friends were leaving him. Travel well, I said. All the seeds of you and the dream of you, the rot. Then I stepped back into the world.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Did you feel like it was you that was holding on to Rosie? I mean, was that something the doctor said and you were like, meh? Or, I mean, were you keeping her? I think you understand the question. Were you?
Yeah.
Did she want to go? Did you have that? You have such a strong sense of her as a being in the book.
Right, right, right.
As a, I mean, you play around with those ideas of all of us being dog.
Right, 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 right. Yeah.
Did you have a sense that she wanted to die?
I wasn't completely sure, and I still feel guilty about that. It really became when I could do it.
Right.
You know, because it was like she got so still, she got like, she hardly seemed alive. She was just lying so kind of dead-like. And when I saw that, and it felt like there was like nothing left, and she already was pretty incontinent, it was just like I suddenly just thought, I can do this. And I can do this right away, you know, and it was like a Friday night, and I just knew that if I just woke up Saturday morning and ran to the vet's office, I could do it, you know? So, I mean, what is that? I don't know. It was my own ability. And I don't know what she wanted. And I do in some ways still feel guilty. In some ways, I probably wrote the book out of guilt as much as anything else.
What's the guilt, do you think?
You know, should I have just let her drop dead on her own? I mean, I was always like, how will I know that it's time to, you know, put her down. I didn't ever know that it was the right time. It was the same old thing. I knew that I could. I knew it was like a practical decision. I mean, I went to an animal communicator and she listed all the things that she liked and she seemed to make it very clear that if I was hell-bent on moving to Los Angeles, which I was kind of at that time, Rosie, that was not going to really work for Rosie and she was probably not going to be there. And I moved to Los Angeles anyway. You know what I mean? There was a couple of things that I did that either healthcare people or animal communicators said, don't do that. And I did that. So all that feels strange still, too.
Is that, this is how I'm hearing you, and maybe this isn't what you meant at all.
Mm-hmm.
You put your own needs first. You have this path that you're on, and you're kind of hell-bent on getting there.
Well, that's definitely true. But I think I was more thinking about this, I mean, like I have this practical side, and I think it might even be class or just something pragmatic where it's sort of like I'm a poet because I realized I was writing poems. She died then because I saw that I could do it. You know, it's just sort of like, there's just an opening, and I've been good at or lucky enough to take these openings, and that's how I've gotten from here to there. You know, but there is also the other thing. I think the thing you described is more of this compulsiveness, which is also guiding and ruling me a lot, too. It's like the part of me that can't stop. It's probably why I write in some ways. There's some part that is just out of control and can't stop. You know, and so I've found a little realm where I can go do that.
I briefly mentioned this, but this idea that runs through Afterglow about this idea that we're all kind of dog. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, I suppose it's a book about God or about spirituality in some way. And I feel like the closest I got to it was through this creature, you know? And so there's that joke, the famous joke, the God-dog reversal. And I literally got that realization at one point in her dying where I thought, oh my God, this is how I know God. Is this taking care of this dog? This is it. This is the spiritual occasion. This is how I get in.
Was it the aspect of service and being of service to something else that prompted that?
Yeah. And service, I mean, it's sort of like, I think I was in Hawaii once, and I went in a state park to a cliff at night where lava was flowing into the ocean. And it was just incredible. And I was just like, the thing that was incredible about it was that I was no place else. I thought, oh, this is what sublime means. Like, you just can't think of, I was kind of like, what time should I go back? I think I've seen a long, for a period of time, there was only lava and falling into the ocean. There wasn't even a me. And anytime I've been close to somebody dying, I've felt there are moments of that where I feel like I forget myself. And I felt like I forgot myself taking care of her a lot at the end. And I thought, this is so perfect.
You grew up Catholic. You went to Catholic school. And the idea of hell recurs in your work. You have a book called Inferno. You wrote the libretto for an opera called Hell. And you were recently joking about this taco place that opened near you called Diablo.
Right.
And how devils now are appearing in your work
as
a result of that. What do you think that is? And have you thought about what you think hell is?
Oh, God. I don't know. I mean, I think hell is suffering. I mean, I think it's suffering. I think it's being trapped. I think this might be hell where we are, you know? And I think we kind of make jokes about it, and we make up devils, and we make up these funny people that look weird that, you know? I sort of suspect this is hell, you know?
Do you suspect there's something beyond hell?
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, I don't know what happens when we die, you know, and I think the problem of materiality, you know, I think all these moments of bliss we have in life are when we start, whether it's an orgasm, whether it's a great run, whether it's a spectacle that, you know, like natural or a piece of art that you're like, oh my God, and you lighten and you just forget the corporal weight and the drudgery and the too much time. You know, so I think that bliss, that heaven is, you know, bliss is heaven. But I think hell is just like regular.
Right.
You know, it's like, I remember walking down St. Mark's, you know, place one hot, hot August day. And I was like, I think I was upstate where it was nicer, but I had to go into the city for something and I had to do all my errands and it was horrible. And I remember walking down the street thinking, oh, this is like, and then suddenly I reversed it and I thought, it will always be like this. It will always be like this. It will always be like this. And it was so weird that I started to feel better instantly.
Oh, interesting.
Like I had to completely succumb to it, you
right.
know? You know, and that's about the only thought I have about this.
You're reminding me, I interviewed Daniel Kahneman, who's a behavioral economist. And one of the things he said was, when talking about prison sentences, that in a sense, they become less effective the longer they are because you acclimate to it. And that idea of walking down St. Mark's and it being August and miserable and going, it will always be like this. And then you felt better. Uh-huh. It really reminded me of that, and it feels really true that we can kind of adjust to anything,
right.
And we do.
Right, right. It's that frog in the cold water.
Right.
And, yeah.
you boil alive.
Yeah, or a political situation right now.
Right. Huh. You ran for president, and this was in 1992?
91. I began in 91. I ended in 92 when they had an election.
It was a form of political protest, you've said.
And a form of art, too. You know, making speeches and stuff.
Did it force you to really confront what you thought a president should do?
Totally, totally. And it made me see how every person who was willing to could be forced to think of what they would do if they had a country to run. It was kind of amazing. It was just like, what would be my inventory? You know, like what would I do with defense? What would I do with culture? What would I do with the environment? And I found that I knew. And if I didn't know, I would find somebody who knew more about that than me. We would sit down and figure it out.
So you just mentioned our current political situation. I think it's difficult for many people and probably most of the listeners to this podcast. Do you have sympathy as somebody who ran for the office as what would, I mean, assuming you had won, you would have been a novice in the office, a political novice. Do you have sympathy for the current, any sympathy for the current political novice in the office?
I do. Yeah, because I think that when I was running, I mean, I didn't really think I was going to win, but I felt like
apparently neither did he.
Yeah, and I had to confront the likelihood. Like, what if I won?
Mm-hmm.
And I had to decide that if I won, I was willing to serve because I had to confront that boundary. And I think, like you said, it's true. I think it's a terrible job. And I think this guy is miserable in it, doing it, you know? So I do. I feel sympathy for that much.
What would your list be if you were to get into office now?
You know, I would add cabinet posts. Like, we have no Department of Culture. We have no, I would make a Department of Women just because, I mean, I think women should be simply integrated culturally, but we're not. And so I think that it's sort of like the way you start something is to consciously add it in and make it be like a program.
What would a Secretary of Women do?
Perhaps look at where women weren't and try and figure out why that was. I mean, unfortunately, things like I think there are countries in the world where they actually have quotas. Like, it's sort of like Congress has to look like the country.
Right.
You know, and I think ours should. But so I don't know, the president gets to do that, but the president could start to talk about things like that through a cabinet post.
Have you ever seen in your life your politics reflected in a president?
No, not really. Not really. I think everybody has been too conservative.
Right.
It seemed, I mean, like everybody who's supposed to be Kennedy was not so liberal. He was pretty conservative. I was riding home last night with this guy, Federico, and we were talking about politics. And I think we both agreed that Kennedy and Trump have more things in common than we would like to admit.
Meaning what?
Well, they were sort of rich boys. They were sort of like, they were not inexperienced and maybe kind of like a little deluded in terms of what they could do and what their powers were. I mean, Kennedy, if I believe Seymour Krim in this great book, The Dark Side of Camelot, Kennedy had a mole. There was somebody that was giving him information about Russia that he thought was like a personal contact that came to him, and it was really good. And everybody in the State Department was like, that's like a mole. This is like a spy, or this person is not a person to be trusted. And Kennedy was just like, this rich boy that I know how to get, you know, the good stuff. And there was all sorts of, you know, like the Bay of Pigs. There were so many things that were a total disaster.
I wasn't going to do this, but you brought it up. And I feel like as a Massachusetts native.
Yeah, because you can't call the nickname that probably I don't like using, that they call people from Massachusetts now.
Masshole?
Yeah. Don't like it. Huh.
That word did not come to my mind. Yeah. I was actually thinking of the word, and I've never even said it out loud because I don't know how it's pronounced. Yeah. Habitué?
Oh, okay. Nice. Yeah, I think that's right.
Is that the pronunciation? And I'm not even sure I'm using it correctly.
Yeah, yeah.
But in American Poem, one of your poems, you talk about being a Kennedy.
Right. Yeah.
Do you, would it be proper to ask you to read an excerpt?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Just a little piece.
Yeah. So, I guess from where, right where it says
to,
I don't know, until you feel like it's
okay.
Until you feel like you're done. I don't know.
My attempts to remain obscure have not served me well. Starting as a humble poet, I quickly climbed to the top of my profession, assuming a position of leadership and honor. It is a right that a woman should call me out now. Yes, I am a Kennedy, and I await your orders. You are the new Americans, the homeless wandering the streets of our nation's greatest city. Homeless men with AIDS are among them. Is that right? There's no homes for the homeless? That there's no free medical help for these men and women? Did they get the message as they are dying that this is not their home? And how are your teeth today? Can you afford to fix them? How high is your rent? If art is the highest and most honest form of communication of our time, and the young artist is no longer able to move here to speak to her time. Yeah, I could, but that was 15 years ago. And remember, as I must, I am a Kennedy. Shouldn't we all be Kennedys?
What does that mean to you to say I am a Kennedy?
Because
it sounds like you have some disdain for this Massachusetts royalty, these Kennedys.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's mixed. I mean, it's sort of like growing up in Massachusetts, it was like on the wall was the Pope and Jack Kennedy. You know, it was just like, whoa, you know, they were just these icons. But it was also, you know, like I worked at the Harvard Coop in high school. I had my Catholic school uniform and I had a light blue smock. And I would just witness. I mean, I was obsessed with class all my life. I guess I wanted to be from another class where I could have the, you know, it was like a gender yearning. It was like if I was in this other class, I could take the lessons I wanted and wear the clothes that I wanted and have the mobility that I wanted. And I didn't have any of that. And so I would just see these kids in these like very, you know, guys in these beautiful tweed top coats and rumpled chinos and barefoot and then really expensive loafers in the winter and kind of a dirty T-shirt. And I just knew there was this kind of rich guy way of just kind of being sort of cavalier with these lovely fabrics and your kind of own smelly, unwashed body, and you would just sort of be in bad as somebody who would just be a future rich guy. I mean, I would look at the Boston Globe and look at what schools they went to, and I was like, Brown and Nichols, what's that? You know, and I just remember meeting a girl at the Coop. I mean, like, I would work with people who were from more upper class backgrounds, and somebody would just think it would be nice if they would have a little job. And this girl went to the Beaver Country Day School. I was like, holy God, you know, but I was fascinated. I was fascinated by their beautiful skin and their healthy look and their well-fed smartness. It was a cavalierness. And I think that's what I associate with the Kennedys the most was a way of being kind of loose with beautiful things and having access to them and being bad in a way that meant there was abundance. And my badness never seemed to mean that, you know? And I think the Kennedy, I mean, the poem was really about, I mean, even when I came to New York, I think I was very aware that people from lower class backgrounds didn't tend to come into the poetry world and really do well. And so I think I remember thinking that I'm just going to pretend to be an upper class person coming down.
And was that behind, you talked about your accent. Mm-hmm. And how you used to kind of hide it a little bit.
I don't know. No, I think not.
Oh, you did not?
No.
Am I misreading?
Maybe. I mean, it was just like, it was variable. I guess I was aware of when to use it and when not to use it. Yes. So that, I guess that's, which I think I read about that in D.H. Lawrence. Like, he did that. Like, I think in Sons and Lovers, he would go to pick up his father's check at the coal company, and he would go to that little window, and that's when he would put on the working class accent just to get the check and be a regular guy. And then he would, I mean, maybe he went to Oxford or something, you know.
It's a tiny thing, but do you feel like the accent serves you now?
Sure, because it's like a ingredient. You know, there was just like, I think something I read had to ba and ka. You like that star? I buy you that ka. You know, and I was just like, that's like a double down Boston accent, you know, and stuff. And I think I decided to pretend to be who I was when I came to New York in a way.
I decided to pretend to be who I was.
Yeah.
I think I understand what that means, meaning you had this person in you.
I had a persona, which I knew how you might see me. And I thought that would be cool.
do you think, as somebody who's obviously thought a lot about gender and gender issues, what do you think men miss most about women? What are we not, if there's one thing that we're like, we just don't get, what is that?
Oh, I think that that women see them.
Wait, can you explain that?
Well, I think that men often act like they're invisible around women. You know, and they just like say horrible things, do really stupid stuff as if nobody's listening. Women are taking this all in. I mean, you're with somebody who's like actually a kind of a substantial opponent, you know, or a substantial ally. You know, like women have so much knowledge. You know, I think men miss how much knowledge and information women have about the world. Obviously, I think the problem with our system is it's not being used.
In Afterglow, you talk about lesbians being, I didn't mark it, but I think you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. The stoppage in gender and weird. I mean, it's like very weird.
But it's deep. I mean, it's profound. You're talking about lesbians as sort of being emblems of the world in a way, and having some kind of deeper knowledge about the world. And I will admit to you that I didn't fully get it when I was reading it.
Right.
I was like, I don't quite know what that means.
Yeah, yeah. Well, part of it, some of it's fun, because I think that it's sort of like, it's really fun to front load the notion of the lesbian being this very special, weird spiritual character. It's just like not a theory that you see out and around.
Yeah.
And so it's just kind of like, it's like putting my, you know, it's just throwing some stuff around that is just kind of like putting my team out there in a kind of like, this will be fun.
Well, did you mean it?
But I also, but on the other hand, it's sort of like there is such a thing as patriarchy. We do live in a planet and a culture that is completely dominated by men. And I think the people that live in a way that is most kind of impervious to it, and then also probably most in danger because of it, are lesbians. I mean, it's sort of like, who would be so stupid as to love women? A woman would be that stupid, you know? and so it means you're really
Men are also that stupid too. I mean, we also love women.
Yeah, but you still get to be a man. You know, it's sort of like you've not lost your privilege. You know, and I have perhaps. I've really put myself outside of the economy by that loving. I mean, part of the pleasure and the fun of putting it there in this text is that, you know, like, so I think lesbians suffer a lot. You're like, just kind of like, you're kind of alone in this weird little boat, you know? And it's just like, nobody's saying, yay. I mean, it's different. It's better now. But it still is that it's not like a great culturally approved sentimental ad on television for this couple having a great moment, you know? This is how you're going to sell a product. Nothing's going to get sold that way. I remember Holly Hughes' great quote is, the only cool lesbian is a dead one.
Whoa.
I mean, it's funny. And she's always good at being funny in a really awful way.
It feels more awful than funny, but I'm on the outside of it.
Yeah.
Well, Eileen Miles, as we wrap up, I end each episode with a segment called The Amazing Five, in which I will ask for a recommendation in each of five categories.
Oh, my God.
And I'm thinking of adding a sixth, and maybe I'll start today with you, and then maybe I'll further refine it. But anyway, food. Any food that you love?
Spaghetti and meatballs.
It's funny. You're the second person who recommended spaghetti and meatballs. I wish I could remember who was first. Anybody's in particular?
Oh, God. You know what I mean? Like, I think they're probably long gone, those recipes.
Mm.
Though, actually, I was in Provincetown, and my friend Steve Magliocco, who is an architect.
It sounds like a guy who could make a meatball.
Oh, yeah. And he's so Italian that he refers to it as the gravy. And we were like, we've got to have the gravy, Steve. And his boyfriend is Michael, and we had it last week, and it was amazing. Yeah, yeah.
Do you prefer a large meatball or a small meatball?
Sort of medium.
A medium meatball.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind a sausage in there too.
Uh huh. Spicy or sweet?
Spicy.
Okay, I'm with you. And how thick do you like your gravy?
I don't like it that thick. I mean, I think it like. Yeah, I don't like it so filled with meat. I like, because I really like the meatball. I think it's sort of like the sauce doesn't have to be so meaty.
Music.
Music. God. You know, I'm still like a huge, huge Elliott Smith fan. I love those songs. Can I take you? Arthur Russell.
I don't know who Arthur Russell is.
Oh my God, he's like he was sort of a composer. He kind of was in the disco scene. He died of AIDS in the 90s. He was in the disco scene. He was in kind of a avant-garde Philip Glass kind of world, and he also backed up Allen Ginsberg with like like a bass. He was kind of in a Buddhist scene, but there was a
Philip Glass and the disco scene don't feel like they have a ton of overlap to me.
But there was a dance scene. There was something, it still exists, called the Loft, and it was like the quintessential dance party, as it was like kind of non-commercial disco kind of, and it was like people getting together who just like to really dance. What was amazing, so I went to some loft parties in the like early 80s, and it wasn't, I mean, I wasn't a denizen, but when I was there I was like, whoa, this is it. And there was the Loft had a party like right after the election. It was great. And it's very, you know, very interracial, very mixed age scene, and just people just dancing. And I was like, this is political, this is what we need.
Have you noticed those dance parties that occur outside, like Mitch McConnell's house? And
really?
Yeah. Whenever there is some sort of shit legislation being considered or passed, whoever's kind of on the hot seat of that will sort of be on the receiving end of these dance parties that, that kind of spring up. And so people will come and dance outside their houses and make a lot of noise and be joyous. It's pretty remarkable.
That's incredible.
Film or television?
Huh. Television right now, I'm watching Better Call Saul. I love that show. And I'm somehow, I just kind of identify with Saul, and I have at least one best friend. I was like, we're both Saul. We're very Saul.
What is it about that character that you feel
like
you're...
just, he's so driven, and he's so kind of, he kind of messes up all the time, and yet he's sort of triumphant, and he's very charming, and he talks. He's a good talker. He's making it, he's a salesman, which I feel like I am.
Interesting. What do you feel like you're selling exactly?
Anything. I've been selling all my life, you know? I'm selling poetry. I'm selling queerness.
Yeah.
You know? I belong to a really bad Girl Scout troop, but I was really in it to sell cookies, and I was really good at it.
Wait, I did that. I did that. I did...
Art? No?
Well, these are all art, but if you've got a fine artist, I'd love to hear it.
Oh, Nicole Eisenman.
Okay, so this is going to fill my new category, which is a person that you would recommend. And she's an artist.
Yeah, she's a painter and sculptor, but she can really draw. And she's on the cover of some of my books. And she's like the original Chelsea Girls. There was like a little drawing of like women writhing and stuff. She's queer. And her work is just funny. It's just really kind of over the top, large. She does murals and small. You know, I mean, she's just, you know, she's been making work since the 90s. She's got a good career. She's pretty famous.
What am I forgetting? Did I forget one?
A book?
Oh, book. Of course.
I have a book. It's called 15 Dogs. 15 Dogs. And it's by a guy named Andre Alexis. And he's Canadian. And And the book is incredible. It's like, because I had to start, you know, researching the dog category. You know. But his book, 15 Dogs, is basically Apollo and Hermes are having a drink. They seem sort of like maybe gay men. I don't know. Maybe just a couple of guys hanging out. And they're talking about how screwed humans are, how bad humans are, how we mess everything up. And they were like, is it the intelligence or is it the body? What is it? And the other god says, I don't know. Let's make a bet. And so they, as gods do, just walk through the walls of a vet's office, and it's at night, and there's 15 dogs in crates. And one says to the other, so what if we endow all 15 dogs with human intelligence? And we're going to follow them until the moment of their death and see if they die happy. And that's the book.
That's a great premise.
And you will cry. You will. I have cried. This book is amazing. And he's such a good writer, and he really does it.
Wow.
It's a beautiful book.
Great. Recommendation. Yeah. And then finally, and I'm going to ask for the first thing that comes into your mind.
Whoa.
Miscellaneous. Anything from your life that you would recommend to others?
Oh, God. You know, mountains.
Mountains?
Yeah, I love mountains.
What do you do in mountains? Are you a hiker? Are you a skier?
I've hiked, but it's more like I'm like, they are awesome, you know? And it makes me feel kind of right scaled when I see mountains. It's just, they're silencing. They kind of make like small feelings seem really small, you know? And I think they kind of give you this feeling of how old the earth is and how it's been through all these things, you know? And it'll
keep chugging along.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have favorite mountains?
Well, I love the ones in Texas. I mean, I guess it's at the Chinati Mountains. I don't even know what you call these mountains. The Davis Mountains. Yeah. Big Bend National Park, all those, you know, around there is glorious. West Texas, great.
Well, Eileen Miles, I want to thank you so much for taking the time and being here. The new book is called Afterglow, A Dog Memoir. Eileen Miles, thank you so much for all your work over the years, and thank you for being amazing.
Thank you.
How to Be Amazing is brought to you by PRX. Like How to Be Amazing on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @HTBA_show. And check out our website at howtobeamazingshow.com. If you like what you've heard, give us a nice review. Give us a nice review on iTunes. And if you think we suck, then please still write us a nice review. How to Be Amazing is produced by Jennifer Brennan and Mary Shimkin. It's recorded at Argo Studios in New York City. Today's show is mixed and edited by Robin Lynn, with music composed by Chad Crouch. If you would like information about sponsoring our show, email sponsor@prx.org. I'm Michael Ian Black.